It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This afternoon at 2, internationally regarded public policy expert Robert D. Putnam is giving an address at the University of Pittsburgh entitled Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis, based on his most recent book of the same title, as part of the American Experience Distinguished Lecture Series. Dr. Putnam is the Peter and Isabel Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government and has been a public policy consultant to President Obama, as well as Presidents George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Additionally, Dr. Putnam has advised the last three prime ministers of Great Britain, and he is the author of 15 books, including the internationally acclaimed Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of American Community. He joins us now in studio. Dr. Putnam, welcome to Essential.
It's great to be with you.
Dr. Putnam, you say the American dream has become a dream deferred for millions of Americans. What happened?
Well, a lot of good things have happened in America over the last 50 years. We're a somewhat less racist society. There's less gender discrimination. We have niftier telephones. But some big bad things have happened over this period, too, with respect to social class. First of all, there's this growing income gap between rich folks and poor folks that there's been a lot of talk about this year, and that means rich parents have more resources that they can invest in their kids, and impoverished parents don't. Secondly, there's, and even more important, but less well known, there's American society has become more segregated in class terms. We're a less segregated society in religious terms. Used to be Protestant neighborhoods and Catholic neighborhoods and Jewish neighborhoods and so on. Now we're all mixed up. We're a less, somewhat less segregated society in racial terms than we used to be, but we're much more segregated in social class terms, which means increasingly rich folks are living in enclaves with other rich folks, and poor folks are living increasingly concentrated in poor enclaves, and many fewer of us are living in mixed or moderate income neighborhoods. And that has a lot of implications because it means rich kids are mostly going to school now only with other rich kids, and poor kids are mostly going to school only with other poor kids. It even affects things like whom we marry. Increasingly, rich folks only marry other rich folks, and poor folks, if they marry at all, only marry other poor folks.
That sounds like the kind of thing that went on 100 years ago in this country.
Yeah, we are moving pretty rapidly, and this is a big deal, toward two Americas in which people who are doing all right, basically that means, I'm not talking about Bill Gates in the upper 1%, I'm talking about the upper third of American society. Basically, that's college-educated Americans. If you have a college degree, you're almost automatically in the top third of American society. And I'm comparing those folks and their kids with people who haven't gotten past high school. Maybe they have a high school degree, maybe they don't, but they haven't gotten past high school. That's the lower third of American society of all races. I'm not talking just about blacks or non-whites. I'm talking about all Americans. And so those two groups, the upper third and the lower third, are increasingly separated from one another. They have increasingly many different resources, and the traditional family and community ties within what we used to call the working class are also fragmenting. For example, nowadays, more than two-thirds of all kids who are born to high school-educated moms are living in single-parent families, more than two-thirds of all of them. This is not about race. It's about social class. So the bottom line is American society is becoming more divided. This book of mine asks, what difference does it make for kids? And what we find is it makes a huge difference for kids. So increasingly, there's a gap. We showed in the book in a series of what we call scissors graphs. Kids coming from affluent homes are doing better and better. Kids coming from impoverished homes are doing worse and worse in many different ways. And that net effect of that is it's going to be harder and harder for kids to move out of the lower class, no matter how talented they are. That basically violates the core principles of American society. The core principle is how well you do in life should depend upon your God-given talents and your hard work, but shouldn't depend upon what your parents did or didn't do.
Is this a new phenomenon in America, or is it a return to what we had in the late 19th century, the early part of the 20th century, in terms of the kind of disparity between the haves and the have-nots? You heard about Horatio Alger's stories in America years ago. can they still happen today, or are we looking at something different today?
Well, it's a really good question. So here's, roughly speaking, what's happened over the period since the what was called the Gilded Age, you know, the age of the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Mellons and the other folks that were making a lot of money at the end of the 19th century, exactly as you say. Then there was a big gap between rich and poor, and it had effects on kids then. But in the early years of the 20th century, around 1910, plus or minus, America transformed itself. We were able, as a country, to begin to reduce those opportunity gaps. And for most of the 20th century, the opportunity gap and the social and income gaps in America were narrowing year by year. That was, you could see this in distribution of income. You could see it in whom we lived alongside. You could see it in whom we got married to. You could see in our generosity. America was becoming, during the first two-thirds of the 20th century, that is from around 1900 to around 1960 or 70, we were becoming more and more a we society in which we all looked out for everybody's kids, not just our own kids. But beginning in the late 60s or early 70s, all of those trend lines reversed. And so for the last 40 years, America has become more and more an I society, not a we society. More and more people, when they talk about our kids and doing things for our kids, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, when my parents used the term our kids, they meant all the kids in town. They said, we need a swimming pool for our kids. They weren't talking about a swimming pool in our backyard for my sister and me. They were talking about everybody should, you know, pay a few higher taxes. So there was a swimming pool at the high school.
They were thinking in terms of the well-being of the community.
Absolutely. And all the kids in town, the rich kids and poor kids, all counted as our kids. But over the course of the last 30 or 40 years, the meaning of our kids has shriveled as we've moved from being a we society to being an I society. So now if you talk to people in my own hometown, a little town in Ohio, and people, you talk about poor kids now, people say, well, they're not my kids, they're somebody else's kids, let somebody else worry about them.
Do we know why that is?
Yeah, we don't know, actually. It's a big change, a big sea change in America, and I think we have to turn it around, because if we don't, America's going to be heading in a direction unlike anything we've actually ever done before. So I don't think America, we are all in this together. What I mean by that, it's not just when we talk to hundreds of poor kids and rich kids around the country for this book and lots of individual case studies. I think probably most college-educated Americans simply don't have any idea how awful the lives that these poor kids nowadays are living. So part of the point of the book and the lecture that I'm going to be giving later today is to say to affluent or educated Americans, do you really know what life is like down there at the other side of the American society?
And do we? Do Americans, are they aware of this?
No, I think they're not. I think that's one reason why the book has gotten a decent amount of attention, because the last time we went through this period, 100 years ago, when we had these big gaps, one of the turning points was a book written by a Danish-American journalist in New York City called How the Other Half Lives. And it was a quite famous book because
we hear that phrase quoted quite often.
Absolutely. It comes to the title of that book, and it was a book that described in words and pictures the squalor of the tenement slums on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, aimed to be read by the rich folks in the silk stocking districts on the Upper East Side of New York. And it simply said, do you know what life is like down there? It's only 10 miles from you. Do you know what life is like down there? And some rich folks read it and said, yeah, sure, that's fine. It's their problem. I'm not my problem. But some of the affluent folks at that time said, actually, I didn't know that because of the greater segregation and that's what we're having now. And that was the start. Recognizing the problem was the start of this era that I said in which we began to turn it around. I'm not claiming that my book, Our Kids, is going to have the same impact as How the Other Half Lives, but that's the genre in which I've written this book. I'm trying to describe and then to lay out not only just the stories, but to lay out the data that shows how in the last 30 or 40 years there's been this growing gap between affluent kids and poor kids.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and my guest is Robert D. Putnam. He's giving an address at the University of Pittsburgh entitled Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis, based on his most recent book of the same title. Paul Krugman, the economist who writes a syndicated column for the New York Times, said in one of his recent columns, given the reality that wealth often reflects luck or power, there's a strong case for collecting some of that wealth in taxes and using it to make society stronger as long as it doesn't destroy the incentive to keep creating more wealth. Is that idea something that could be part of the solution here?
Yeah. Let me say a couple of things about the political framework for this, because we're talking now in this election a lot about the distribution of income. Lots of rich people have done really well, and lots of middle income and poor people have not done so well over the last 30 or 40 years. Historically, Americans have not been as upset as people in other countries about the distribution of income among adults, because historically our attitude has sort of been, well, you know, if we all get on the ladder at the same point, and some of us climb higher, Bill Gates or, you know, Warren Buffett climbs higher than other people, that's just because they're better climbers or because they work harder at it, on the assumption that we're all getting on the ladder at the same point. But about that point, that is the idea that all Americans, everybody, should have the same start in life or approximately the same start in life, that's been a core belief in America from the very beginning. It's not been a partisan issue. Everybody has believed that there ought to be equal opportunity for all kids to get started. When we became a country, the very first thing we said to the world was, we believe that all men are created equal. Now, of course, we meant white men. We didn't, at that point, we didn't mean all men, and we meant men for sure. We didn't mean women. But the core idea, the basic egalitarian promise of America is how well you do in life should depend upon your talents and your hard work, but shouldn't depend upon what your mom and dad did or didn't do. We shouldn't be, have this inherited inequality. And that's why, I mean, Paul Krugman is talking about the distribution of income in one generation. Obviously, that's related to how well the next generation does. But in the past, we had lots of what you might call circuit breakers. That is, lots of things that enabled people, even though their parents weren't wealthy, like to begin with public schools and lots of other things. We were providing help to kids coming from poor backgrounds, and that's what's changed. And where that leads is we're moving rapidly into a situation that no political party can be happy with because it so violates our core principle.
Well, not only that, but you know, it's not just a matter of altruism, is it? Because
no, it isn't.
Because if you are denying certain young people opportunities, they may be the very people that can go on to do great things, cure cancer.
Absolutely.
Come up with brilliant economic ideas.
Absolutely. No doubt about it. The data in the book, among other things, looks at the question of how likely is that kids in America now will complete college, get a four-year college degree, depending upon two things. How smart they are, as measured in test scores in the eighth grade on math, and how much money do their parents have. So rich, smart kids are very likely to complete college. Not so smart, or at least not so good test-taking, poor kids are very unlikely to complete college. But here's the crucial point. Smart, poor kids, that is, they get high test scores, but their parents are not so wealthy, are less likely to complete college now than dumb, rich kids. In other words, your own talent matters less now for completing college than what your parents did or didn't do.
In other words, somebody that has the luck of being born to the right parents or the parents who inherited some large income, they therefore are able to get an opportunity that they may not necessarily be worthy of, whereas a poor kid is not.
Yes, that's true. But I'm actually less worried about the fact that
30%
of rich, not-so-talented kids are going to college. If their parents want to spend money on them going to college, that's fine. But I am very worried about the fact that only 29% of much smarter poor kids complete college. Phrase it a different way, and this is exactly what you were asking me about before. 71% of the smartest kids in America are not completing college, not because they're not smart, but because they come from a poor background. And that means we're losing 71% of exactly the folks whose help we'll need going forward in curing cancer or in some new app or who knows what they could do. And that's a huge economic cost. This is not about altruism. I mean, of course, it is in part about altruism. Part of the reason that I get so upset about these growing gaps between rich kids and poor kids is it's just not fair. It so violates our core values. But The other reason to be worried about it is we can't afford it. The cost of not investing in talented poor kids nationwide over the course of their generation going forward now is, the best economic estimates, is $5 trillion. It's my grandchildren, who are doing fine, and I've got grandchildren who grew up right here in Pittsburgh. They went to good schools, and their parents are not wealthy, but their parents are well-educated, and they're going to do just fine. But the question is, if we help poor kids, is it going to make life better or worse for my grandchildren? And the answer is, it's going to make life better for my grandchildren. It's not like if we help poor kids, it's going to hurt my grandchildren. On the contrary, if we don't help poor kids, it's going to hurt my grandchildren because they're going to be growing up in a poor society.
So what is the answer or the solution to the problem here? And I mentioned Paul Krugman earlier. Is it about wealth distribution? Does that solve the problem, or is there another answer?
Well, can I go back to the very beginning of our conversation when you asked me about 100 years ago? Because that story turns out to be remarkably relevant to this question. You remember where we got in that story was there'd been this golden age, lots of inequality, lots of derelict poor families, and their kids were not able to move forward.
And then there was and people weren't aware of the problem, then there became an awareness, and then there was a solution.
Yeah, well, not just one solution. There are many solutions, but the one I want to focus on is probably unknown to many of your listeners, and that is, in 1910, Americans invented the high school. That is, for the first time in world history, Americans said, all kids in town, just by virtue of being kids in town, deserve to have 4 years of secondary education for free. That's what the high school is. It's 4 years of secondary education for free for all kids, just if they're kids in town. Nobody in the world had ever done that before. It's expensive because it's not easy to give every kid in town a free high school education. But it turned out to be the best public policy decision ever made. It began, by the way, didn't come from Cambridge, Mass. It didn't come from Pittsburgh or from New York or Washington. It came from small towns in the Midwest, in Iowa and Kansas and Nebraska and the Dakotas and Minnesota and so on. And then it spread very rapidly. Here's the pitch you had to make. You had to say to the wealthy lawyer and banker and farmer in town who'd already paid for their kids to get a free secondary education, and their kids were now off in Chicago or someplace, Detroit, making a lot of money. You had to say to them, you should pay higher taxes so that other kids in town, other people's kids, can have the same advantage that your kids had. Hard sell. Turned out to be the best public policy decision Americans have ever made because it did two things simultaneously that economists tell us you can't do together. On the one hand, it created an enormous boost in the productivity of the American workforce because the Americans then had the best workforce, educated workforce in the country. That one decision to have universal high school education for everybody explains most of American economic growth throughout the 20th century. So this is a huge deal. It more than doubled our productivity growth. It had a huge effect, positive. And so even the bankers and lawyers and rich farmers, they were better off because of the country's growth. And at the same time, it leveled the playing field so that everybody had that fair, equal start. That's what economists tell us you usually can't do. You've either got to choose either equity or efficiency. And in fact, this was both. Now, I use that example for several reasons. First of all, we've been here before as America, and we could do this again. It's not like I'm saying, you know, we should become like Sweden. I'm saying we should just do what Americans have done before faced with a problem like this. Secondly, the answer didn't come from Washington and didn't come from Cambridge. It came from
the heartland.
The heartland of people trying to figure out how can we solve this problem. How can we narrow these opportunity gaps here in, you know, East Elbow, Iowa, whatever? The idea turned out to be so good that it spread rapidly across the country. Thirdly, what's the 21st century equivalent of inventing the high school? It's not the high school. I mean, we've done that, and I'm not trying to say, okay, we need to reinvent the high school. But we need to think of big investments, because it was costly to invent the high school. It turned out to be a really good investment because those bankers and farmers and businessmen got their return from that investment. Now, I think my nominee for the 21st century equivalent is really early childhood education, because what we've learned in the last 10, 15 years from brain science is that lots is happening in the infant brain between birth and kindergarten. And affluent families in America, in effect, know that. They know that you should read Goodnight Moon and you should spend a lot of time with your kids and so on. Impoverished families in America can't or don't do that. And we could have a huge positive effect on kids coming from poor backgrounds if we gave them high-quality early childhood education.
Is it a matter of politicians selling the idea to the public because there's so much of an argument that persists about whether or not you should raise taxes? Is it about getting people not to think of it in terms of, oh my goodness, I'm going to have to pay more in taxes, and realizing that this is an investment that, while it may not pay off in your lifetime, it's going to pay off in the lives during the lifetimes of your children and their children?
Yeah, and I guess I could say, in fact, the real question is pay now or pay later. Because if we pay now and we get all of those really smart poor kids, we provide them with a start in life such that they can contribute to all of us will be better off. That's not going to be 50 years from now. That's going to be 10 or 15 years from now. Secondly, if we don't fix these problems, it's going to mean much higher criminal justice expenses and much higher health system expenses. So we're all going to be better off if we make this investment.
We've been talking with Robert D. Putnam, who is giving an address at the University of Pittsburgh entitled Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis. It is based on his most recent book of the same title, and it's part of the American Experience Distinguished Lecture Series. Again, it's happening at 2 o'clock today on the University of Pittsburgh campus. Dr. Putnam, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Essential
Thanks.
Pittsburgh.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA.